are heating up, people. They are heating up. South by Southwest, I guess, is happening now. It's I'm actually doing this right before I put this out. It's Wednesday. It's early evening, late afternoon. Have a gig tonight. I'm gonna finish this monologue, and then put this podcast out to you guys. How did I get here? Episode 50. This is our 50th episode. I guess I should have some kind of party. I guess I'm going to. I'm having a party right now, and it's happening inside my pants. Just me alone having a party in my pants, which is unbelievably exciting for everyone listening. So yeah, 50 episodes. I'd like to thank you all for listening. I'd like to thank all of my guests for coming on here. My guest today is a guy I've known for a while, a guy named Matt the Electrician. You might know him if you've seen him throughout the country or in Europe playing or around Austin. He's done a lot of stuff with Bob Schneider. He's opened Bob Schneider's Mondays at Saxon Pub here in Austin for about a decade. He's done tours of Japan. He's going to do one later this year. He's done stuff out in Europe and England. And so Matt came by. I was staying watching my dogs at my ex-girlfriend's place, and so we had it was a beautiful day. We sat outside and talked, and it was great. So I hope you enjoy my conversation with Matt the Electrician. Here it is. Matt the Electrician.
Sunshine down all the dirt roads all through the summertime. Hey Dad, I think we're going in the wrong direction. Tourist destination, family vacation. 1, 2, 3, 4. Quick, take a picture next to that statue. Put on this t-shirt.
You know, feel good about it. Felt like we sold enough to make it worthwhile, but at the same time, just feels like you put all this time and energy into this thing, this CD, and it's, you know, thematic, or it's what the artwork, all of it. You put so much effort and money into it, and like a month later, you get people writing you little emails or comments saying,
When's your next record coming out?
I'm going, come on, man. I just spent 20 grand and like, you know, 3 months intensive and a year's worth of writing to put this out. And I know that they mean it, and, you know, it's great that they. That we even get to have fans, and then we get people that care, that, you know, that want to hear the next thing.
Yeah, but still, like, I just put it out. So we're rolling. This my guest today is Matt the Electrician, Matt Sever, or is it Sever?
It's Sever.
Sever. Okay, I thought the C might be with an A.
That's right. Yeah,
right,
I think that's
Sever.
Yeah, Sever, like as in to disconnect.
Yeah. Okay, so Matt the Electrician. So your record, Accidental Thief, that came out last June, 2011, it was a different album for you. I was reading the thing about it, that was the first like collaborative writing that you had done. And it seems like it was really inspirational. How many songs did you do on there? Like 8 or something?
I think there's 11 songs on there, and either 5 or 6 of them are co-writes.
Okay. Yeah, I knew there was a good percentage of them.
Yeah.
So that was an inspiring. It was all done in one trip. Explain. So you went to Denmark.
Yeah, I went to Denmark with Troy Campbell and the House of Songs project, and we did this kind of intensive 3-day co-writing thing in this crazy 16th century castle with some folks from Austin, and then also some writers from kind of all over Scandinavia, Norway, Denmark, Faroe Islands, Iceland, Sweden, I think. And it was I think probably somewhat typical of any kind of summer camp type experience. There were 12 of us, and you're kind of locked together for 3 or 4 days, so it's intense. No matter which direction it goes, it ends up being a real intense experience. But beyond that, I think it also, there were just some great connections between people that my previous experience in co-writing I had not necessarily come into contact with. So
Well, on these two, there's an accountability. You have to have a song written by the end and recorded at the end of the day, or you perform it at the end of the day.
Oh,
there,
man,
right?
It was like we started at 9.
Yeah.
You'd go 9 to noon. You had to have one song.
Is there like a den mom or something? Like an overseer? That, hey, man, you're sleeping in until 11. What's going on over here?
There was a guy, Roar Amundsen. He's a Danish guy who runs this stuff. He's a songwriter, but he's also real involved in the performing rights organizations over there and books and festivals. But he works at this folk high school where kids study songwriting. And so he puts together these co-writing sessions a lot over the course of...
No one's there. Taylor, sorry.
It's okay. It looks like somebody's out in front.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Shit.
Unless I'm just seeing...
So take me through a day then. So you'd wake up at 9.
Well, we'd wait...
You'd have an assignment?
We'd wake up at like 7 or 7:30.
Right, start at 9.
Yeah, have breakfast. And then we'd all meet in this big room in the castle. And Roar would... he was really kind of the mastermind of who was going to write with who. He was the guy who decided who was getting invited to begin with.
Right.
And so he had a big chalkboard, and he would just choose, you know, Matt, you're going to go write with, you know, Laura from Iceland today, and Scrappy, you're going to go write with, you know, Ida from Denmark. And so we were put into these rooms for...
with weird names.
Yeah, exactly. And there were tons of rooms all over the castle you could kind of choose from where you were going to go. They all had pianos in them. We had a bunch of loner guitars. And you would go in there, and you had pretty much from 9 to noon.
Which is really all you need.
And at about 11... that's weird. So there really is somebody like knocking on the door now.
So you'd write from 9 to noon.
Yeah, about, I think, 9:45 or so we would break, and we'd meet back in the big room, and everybody would just play what they had. And, you know, there were a couple of times where people hadn't totally finished what they were working on.
Right.
For, you know, 90% of the time, I think there was just that understanding that, like, this isn't the only time you're going to get together with this one person, so you gotta finish.
Yeah.
And so we would come back together, everybody would play the songs live for everybody else, and then... little bit of comment, but not much, and then we'd go have lunch, and then immediately after lunch, they'd put us into another set of groups, and we'd have until 4, and then after that, we had like an hour of kind of downtime before dinner, but from then on, pretty much from 4 until the wee hours of the morning, you would just sign up to go in and record demos.
Right.
Of maybe the song you just wrote, but maybe the song you wrote, you know, early in the morning, and you just hadn't recorded it yet. And by the second day, you had some, you know, some people hadn't recorded their first songs yet. And so,
right.
So all the time was taken up. It was three and a half solid days, two sessions each day, and some extracurricular writing once people had kind of gotten to know one another and said, man, I really want to write with you again, so let's
get together after.
Set aside an hour or whatever. But after that 3.5 days, we all got in buses and went to... the nearby city, like an hour and a half away, and they have a thing called Spot Festival, which is very similar to South by Southwest. It's kind of their industry conference. And we had a show there in this big concert hall, totally packed crowd, where the whole show was just a set list drawn from the 25 songs we had written in those few days.
Right.
We did, I think, 18 of them or something.
Wow.
Live with... you know, pretty stripped down stuff. There was a little bit of percussion here and there, but for the most part, it was just guitars and pianos, and we did a live show with all that stuff we had just written.
That is awesome.
Yeah.
So during that trip, you wrote five or six of these 11 songs that ended up on your record.
Well, I think while I was there, I personally co-wrote like 6 songs, and then 4 of those made it onto the record.
Okay.
Three or four of them made it onto the record. And then I had 2 other co-writes on the record, one of which was Mark Addison, who I record with in Austin, and the other was a guy from L.A. named John Elliott. But with that one, too, it was really inspired by coming back from Denmark and going, man, I want to do some more of this co-writing with people who I know. And, you know.
Yeah, Addison's a good guy with that, too, because he did a lot of that in that same kind of
thing.
He went to that castle that was in France, too, I remember, a long time ago.
Yeah.
So you came back and recorded with him, and just from reading your thing, I've recorded with Mark, and he's one of my very favorite experiences. He knows. I mean, he's a guy that's not shy ever to show himself having a good time. He's never too cool to go, woo!
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And jump up and down when something's fun and exciting, and I get that vibe, especially from listening to songs from this record today. There's a lot of different instrumentation.
Yeah.
Banjos and I couldn't tell if it was ukulele or something
there's
instead
of
guitars
ukulele,
and stuff
yeah.
and like
yeah.
Like, so what was the impetus for that? You get tired of using guitar, or did you write these songs on ukulele, or?
Well, I play a ukulele a lot during my sets, and so I do not half of my writing, but I do maybe a third of my writing on ukulele. I have a little banjo ukulele. Mm. And, but yeah, I mean, working with Mark, I think this last record was maybe my fourth
with him
project with him, and over the years we've had so much fun working together.
Yeah, he loves working with you.
Well, you know, when I first met him years and years ago, I didn't dislike him, but I just didn't, you know, we didn't work together. We just met, and I talked about using his studio, and at the time, for whatever reason, I went a different direction.
Right.
And even thought, like, yeah, I don't know if I could work with this guy. I wasn't hearing some of the other projects he was working on. It was totally cool stuff, but it just wasn't in my wheelhouse of what I wanted to do. And so I kind of wrote it off. And then I guess it was in about 2004 or 2005, I was getting ready to make another record, and Scrappy Judd, who plays guitar with me, said, you know, I really think you ought to rethink Mark. Yeah, I think you ought to work with Mark because... I've heard some recent stuff out of there, and I think you guys would work well together. And so we went in, we made a record, and it was very just kind of a live, very organic acoustic record with my band, and it was a great experience. And so working with him in that way, I kind of got to know him a little bit, and I thought, well, this is fun. And so for the next record, I said, look, I want to do something where it's just me and you, and I don't even want to bring my band in. I'd already made four or five records with my band at that point, and I thought, I want to do something totally different. And so we made the record Animal Boy in 2008 or 2009, something like that. And it was primarily the two of us. I mean, we brought in a few other people to do some things here and there, but it was mostly us playing all of the instruments, and we had such a blast doing that, and we kind of got a thing going at that point.
Yeah.
Which became our system of building these giant crazy buildings out of sound and then deconstructing them.
Yeah.
Which is not a way I had previous to that. No. I hadn't really worked that way.
No, but you get that vibe from the record almost like one of the almost like there's a it's like a vibe on that Yankee Foxtrot Hotel Wilco record that has that same thing. You kind of tell they went in, they had a song, and then they tore it all down and then rebuilt it thinking completely outside of what their normal what their comfort zone is.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah, that always makes for the most fun you can have too.
Well, and I think I felt when I was not that it's a sign of immaturity, but when I was younger, I was very keen on making records that represented what I was doing, like represented the band at the time.
And a snapshot of what we are right now.
Right, and I felt like we accomplished that fairly well over the years. And we could go play a show and people would buy the record and they'd write me a note and say, wow, your record sounds a lot like you do live, that's great.
Yeah.
And I thought, that's a great thing. But once you've made four or five records like that and you know, well, I know we can do this. And I thought, you know, now it's not as important to me. I want to make a record that maybe we can't recreate live, and that's okay, because the live recreation will be different. It'll be a different sound. It'll be, and in that way, it also left the door open for, after we made the Animal Boy record, the guys in my band said, you know, do we have to learn this way? And I said, no, I want you guys to just do what you do. And so we had all these different versions that were live, and it really made then making a live record make total sense, because I thought, why make a live record that sounds exactly like your record?
Right.
You know.
Was that Matt the Electrician is alive?
Yeah.
That's awesome. And you're alive right here.
Yeah.
So as your name states, you were an electrician at one point.
I was.
And apparently... And sometimes at night, if it's quiet enough, I can still hear you wiring something and whistling.
Oh, boy.
So I am. I thought that was a very clever bio. Well, bios are one of those things, and we can totally talk about this. This is really one of those things that people don't talk about enough, I don't think, because bios are terrible.
They are. They're the worst thing in the world. I hate them.
And sometimes people try to be clever, and it doesn't come off like yours. It comes off like, okay. Yeah, real clever. But yours is a good. It's like an earnest. You're like a working musician, man. You brought
You even say something about an honest day's where there's nothing wrong with an honest day's work, and that and you kind of, to me, you have that work ethic in music. Like, you bring that same kind of, like, you work.
Well, I years ago I had bios that were written by other people, and I needed a new one, and I tried to get several other people to write it for me, and it just wasn't panning out.
Yeah.
It sounded too clever.
Sometimes
they're
too long.
Yeah, and so I thought, you know what? I had had enough experiences of playing shows and or reading press about myself where people would just cut and paste the bio, and I thought, I need to put down exactly what I want to read. If I'm opening up a newspaper where there's something about me, I know that journalists apparently, in general these days, are just going to cut and paste a lot of that stuff. So I might as well write what I want to read. And so I tried to do that. And you know, I think that the other facet to that is that I had this name. I have this stage name, Matt the Electrician, that I've sometimes it's been a good thing, and sometimes I've hated it.
Yeah.
You know, you
that's interesting because someone would wonder that too, you know, because to me, I don't even think about it. To me, it's like, I never think about how stupid the name The Beatles actually is with that A in it. Like, what, a dumb name.
Yeah.
It's just them to me. So I never really give, it's just your name to me.
Well, and I think when you're in a town like Austin or when you're in a town or when you're in your hometown, or what has become your hometown, or where people already know you, they don't think about it. But when you go out on the road and you play a place you've never played before, you sit down and people go, "So, are you really an electrician?" And you go through the same old thing over and over. And when I was doing electrical work, it made perfect sense to me. The further away I get from that, the more I think, God, this isn't, you know,
it's going to be Matt Sever.
It's kind of dishonest. But when you put so much time and effort over the years into kind of branding yourself, that you think, well, this, you know, if I was Prince, I could change my name and nobody's going to care because everybody knows who Prince is. But if you're somebody like me and you're somewhere, you've clawed your way to the middle, changing your name could just start you over from zero again.
Yeah.
So I stick with it, but I felt like I needed a way to justify it in a bio. And part of my belief system has always been, you know, I grew up, my dad's a union carpenter in Oregon, and I did about a decade in trades, electrical and carpentry.
So was he always a carpenter?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah?
Yeah.
And did you grow up in Oregon? Are you from San Francisco?
I was born in San Francisco, but I grew up in Southern Oregon and then parts of Northern California. We moved around a lot.
Did anybody play music? Did your mom?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah?
Well,
they all did?
Yeah, nobody played professionally, really. My dad played in a...
Are you going to say, if you go to Southern Oregon, you can go see Steve, the carpenter player?
Yeah, no. He's starting to play gigs now.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, when I was a kid, he always played guitar, and he was in a couple cover bands here and there, but... But, you know, he had a family, and there were three of us kids, and he mostly just worked his day job. But nowadays he's been playing with a friend of his. My sister owns a winery in Oregon, and they're back up in Oregon now. So my dad's been playing like cover songs and stuff.
That's cool.
Yeah.
At the winery. That's awesome.
Yeah.
I should have had kids. I'd secure myself some gigs for later on. So when did you start playing? Did you start playing trumpet or?
I started playing trumpet when I was really little.
Okay.
And studied that all the way through high school and college. I went to college as a trumpet major.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
And he even dropped out of college.
Do you play the horns on your records?
I do. I play all the horns on my records.
Okay, cool. Wow.
Yeah. But was real serious about that for a while and even dropped out of college because I was in a horn section in a world beat band.
Early 90s.
At the time, I thought, you know, there was all sorts of talk and promises of we were going to tour to Africa and all this stuff. And it really just...
That's what they want. A bunch of white hippie kids
playing West African. Yeah, it was a terrible idea. But it was fun. It was fun.
Did you guys tour and stuff?
We did.
Was it a big band?
Obviously, we had a horn section.
So
it was a huge band when we first started. We had upwards of 15 people, and it was rotating.
Wow.
Yeah, and then once I had dropped out of school, and they kind of pared it down because they wanted to do more touring, and so we had gotten it down to, I guess the touring part was like 8 or 9 of us, and we didn't have a van or a bus. I mean, we had 4 or 5
Jesus
cars
Christ.
That would convoy. We never made any money.
Yeah.
And our touring consisted of going from Arcata, California, up on the northwest coast in California, we would go up as far as Seattle, and we would go down as far as Santa Cruz.
Right.
And that was about it. And we would do that every couple weeks, and we continuously lost money.
Yeah.
But it was
the name of it?
It was called Pangea.
So weird, man. At that time, I had a band called Panjandrum. That was like funk and world beat inspired with rock.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Yeah, the early
90s. I mean, the early 90s. Yeah. You could have even just told me the name, and I would have known the year.
Yeah.
So you did that. What made you leave that band? Just kind of like, I want to do something else.
It was kind of terrible. The band was great for 6 months. There was a 6 month period in the 2.5 years we were together where it was really slamming, there were some great, great heavy musicians in the band, and it was really good. And then people started to kind of drop away. I mean, we weren't making any money. Most of us were in our early 20s, but there were a couple guys in their 30s, and I think they just got fed up, and they were some of the heavier players. And so when they were gone, and the lead singer was just it was insane, and it was his thing. And so, you know, at the end of the day, we were doing what he said. And I dropped out of school, stayed up there for a year playing with them, and then I moved south. They were all going to move to San Francisco. And as soon as any of us moved, it just kind of disintegrated. And the band actually still exists. The lead singer still has a band called Pangea, and they still play all over, but it's a completely different lineup.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, I started when I was 15. I started learning to play the guitar, and I started writing songs right away. And really, I think a week after I had written my first song, I got a gig at a coffee shop, and just opening for this guy who played every Friday, who did like, you know, Gordon Lightfoot covers and stuff.
Right.
And did that for maybe a month or two, and then they said, or I think I asked them. I had a bunch of friends. We were all writing songs together about age, you know, 14 to 17. And so I said, hey, nobody's here on Sundays. And usually the coffee shop closed at like 5 or 6 on a Sunday. I said, what if we play from like 6 to 9 on a Sunday? And it was my show, but it was like me and friends.
Right.
And so we would fill 3 hours, and we'd get all of our friends from the high school and all of our parents. And, and I ran that for about a year. It wasn't really an open mic, but it was just kind of a songwriter showcase night. When I was 16, I started it.
Wow.
And right into college, I was writing a lot and playing. But once I started playing a horn and a lot of stuff in a lot of bands in college, I put it down for a couple of years.
Right.
Just wasn't writing as much. And so when I quit Pangea, that was, you know, I thought, you know what? What I really want to do is write songs and do my own thing. And now I've been on the road a little bit. I've learned the lessons you're going to learn from that. And also learned what it meant to be a sideman, which was really good to.
It's a great thing to learn.
And, you know, all lead singers should go through that.
Yeah.
I mean, it's.
I've always done it a lot, and I think that it's kind of kept me as a little bit more of, at least you know how you want to be spoken to in that position by somebody that you're, you know, in our thing, we might be able to pay people, but it's not like we're paying people, you know, the kind of money that you know, so there, you can't really expect more from people than you would expect from yourself in that same position.
Exactly. And I can't remember if it's Danny Barnes or Thor. There's a bunch of people now that have blogs up.
Oh, yeah.
Blog postings up where Danny has one, I know for sure, but I think Thor has another good one that's rules for being a sideman. And it's just this fantastic. I mean, it's a long essay that he's written, but it's, I mean, not just sideman, but every musician should read
it.
It should be required.
Reading. I love Thor. They should find him. So where did you move? Where did you move after that?
Well, when I quit that band, I was living in the Bay Area, in Sonoma County, and everything just in my life seemed to be kind of like coming apart at that point, and which is somewhat typical.
Yeah.
You know, after college, you're not really sure where you're going to go, what you're going to do. And I started playing open mics again, but my relationship was falling apart that I had at the time, and I was living with these guys that were really inspiring. They were visual artists, but they were like guys. They made their own beer. They could take apart a car and put it back together.
Yeah.
They welded and built houses.
Tough arty guys.
Yeah, they were great. And I was, you know, even growing up in a household, you know, with a carpenter, I had never learned any of that stuff. And I started feeling really inadequate around them. But it was great. They weren't very judgmental, and they would just teach me stuff. If I did, you know, I'd ask them, you know, man, I don't know how to change my oil. And they go, all right, Saturday morning, I'll show you.
Yeah.
And they started teaching me that stuff over the course of a year, and I thought, you know what, I need to, I'm enjoying this, and I want to play music, but right here, like, I'm learning this stuff, and my dad, I think, called a week later and said, you know, I need help in his carpentry business. He said, if you come up here, you can stay. You know, again, the typical move back in with mom and dad.
Right. If you come back, we'll set you up with a job. You won't have to pay rent, get you back on your feet. And,
yeah. So I went up and I did that. That's good. Worked with him for a year. And at the end of that year, I think I was writing a lot, playing a lot. And even though we were close to Portland and I liked Portland, I thought, you know what I need to do now? I need to go somewhere that I've never been. I need to go somewhere that I don't know anything about. And although it seems ridiculous these days, I didn't really know anything about Austin. Mm-hmm. In fact, the one thing I knew about Austin was I had this old tape cassette that was it was for promotional use only that I had bought at some sale bin. But I was a huge Poi Dog Pondering fan in high school. Yeah. And I found this tape that was only for promotional stuff, but it had like three songs on it, but it had the band talking in between songs. It was like mostly Frank talking. Right. And I used to listen to that thing all the time, and he would talk about Austin all the time. And I thought, and at the time I wasn't even a big fan of theirs anymore. They had moved to Chicago. But I remember on that tape talking about Austin. Right. And I thought, if a band like that loves Austin,
then I will.
And they're just so weird and eclectic, then I will. I didn't know anything about
them. They were embraced here too. They were beloved. Yeah.
But I know they weren't like native sons. Well, right. Some of them were, but I know that like Frank wasn't. But
right.
But I came here completely ignorant of Guy Clark, Townes Van Zandt,
right.
Butch Hancock,
and you'd never heard of them.
Any of them.
Right,
never even heard of them.
Yeah.
Jerry Jeff Walker, none of it. Never heard. Even Stevie Ray Vaughan, I had a vague sense that he lived here, but had no idea.
Right.
And so really just came here because I thought, well, this one band that I kind of used to like, right. used to live here, so I'm going to go there.
So what was it like when you moved here? Was it intimidating or did you feel welcomed or did you go like, oh, shit?
Well, you know, I was still really in the midst of learning construction stuff. And when I came down here, I knew I had to get a job. And the first job I got as an electrician, as an apprentice, they were working me so hard. It was 96. It was the middle of the boom.
Right.
We were working between 12 and 14 hour days, 6 days a week.
Whoa.
We'd have Sunday off. And so even though I'd come here ostensibly to play music,
you weren't doing much.
The job was all encompassing. And I mean, you know, that's the bio story of the name is that it's true. I mean,
you would go after
I was working
gigs.
For somebody else.
Yeah.
I was an apprentice, and so I would ask him at the beginning of the day, 6:30 in the morning, I'd say, hey, man, I really want to play this open mic tonight. Can I get done by 7? Which, you know, it's 6:30 in the morning. You're thinking 7 o'clock seems reasonable to get off. And he'd go, I don't know. We'll see. And so we'd work and work and work. And then, you know, it would get to be 7:30.
Yeah.
And we're still working. I go, man, I really, really want to go. I want to go play. And And so by the time I got off, I didn't have time to go home.
Right, but you'd still go play the gig.
Oh, just looking like crap. Crawling around in an attic where it's 130 all day. You got insulation all over you. You sweat through everything four times. Just rough. And so, I'd go to these shows and I'd say, hey, I'm sorry.
I'm an electrician.
I'm an electrician. And it really did just kind of stick after that. But it wasn't until about 6 years in I quit. Or no, I guess it was four or five years in I went part-time, which was actually 40 hours a week. And all the guys at the shop called me part-time. And it was kind of frustrating. I would try to explain to them that 40 hours a week was not part-time.
No.
It didn't really sink in. But I think when I really started realizing that, like, to be part of a scene doesn't mean just booking gigs and playing gigs. Because I did that
for a few years. It's immersing yourself in it.
Well, yeah. And it's not even in a crass... you know, opportunistic way, although you can do that as well.
Right, but actually get to know the people, your peers.
Just go to the hole in the wall, go to the sex. And when I finally quit my job in 2001, I remember like the first night I went down to the sex and I ended up meeting Casey Crowley and Billy Harvey and talked to Bob a little bit. I knew Bruce already, Bruce Hughes a little bit just because I had wired his house.
That's weird. I painted his house.
Nice. Did you gouge him too?
No, I didn't get. Someone else was in charge of gouging him. Someone else might have gouged him.
Yeah, but it was. But I remember feeling so excited when I came home that night. I told my wife. I said,
"Were you guys? You guys were already together? Did you meet her here?"
No, she was the part of the relationship that was disintegrating back when I was in California. We've been together since high school.
Oh my God!
But we broke up for a little while, for a year or two, right around post college. And then we moved to different places, and then finally, when I moved here, she decided to, you know, I invited her to come live here, and so.
Wow.
But we've been, it's 22 years this year.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
That's great, man.
Yeah.
She's also an artist as well. She's
visual artist.
Yeah, she does that. She makes clothes and stuff. She has a website. I went and checked out her website and stuff today.
Yeah.
Well, that's awesome, man. You guys have two kids.
Yep.
You're saying one's 11, one's 7?
Yeah, we have an 11-year-old girl and a 7-year-old boy.
Right.
Yeah.
Anyone causing any trouble for you yet?
You know, the 11-year-old's just on the cusp of causing us trouble.
How does this work?
Great.
Talk to me about music.
Yeah.
Like, do they get into your stuff, or are you, like, not Lady Gaga enough for them?
I'm definitely not Lady Gaga enough for them. But no, they're into it. You know, I write songs for them, and they get into that.
How did that change your perspective when you had kids?
That's one of those things that always feels so precious to talk about.
How did it feel to be a musician and grow up? Or be like really responsible for something, not just having your own business or even owning a home, but you have two people that you got to make sure, you know.
Well, I mean, that the thing with having kids is it completely changes your life.
Yes.
And outside of saying that, there's not a lot of better ways to describe it that I've come up with, because I always feel like when people do get too into talking about it, it can come off sounding condescending.
Sure,
or like,
sure.
Hey, if you're not there, you don't understand. Oof. And
It is one of those things. If you're not there, you don't understand.
But that's the thing. Yeah. Is the bottom line is, until you do it, it's something that you can't possibly understand. And it's fantastic, and it's tiring, and it's, you know, horrible at times. And it's all of those things. And, you know, as a musician and as a writer, there's lots of, you know, different parts of your life that get altered that, you know, when you... there are times when you used to write or create or go out and you can't do that anymore. But I've, you know, personally, I've been really lucky and really fortunate that my wife is, you know, because we've been together so long, and I mean, she met me, I already had a gig. You know, I was 15 and she already knew that, like, this is what he wants to do. So it wasn't like I had to shift gears ever and say, oh, I know I was going to law school, but guess what I want to do instead?
Yeah, I know you thought you were going to marry whatever, but now I'm going to do this.
No, she knew going in. And so there's, you know, that being said, we're learning stuff about how it works every day, every month.
Sure.
We do a thing now where we check in. That sounds all therapy or whatever, but
you know, you got to make it work somehow.
Well, yeah, and over the years we've had different systems.
When you check in, what do you mean?
Well, when our little girl was born, and she was a baby, my wife wasn't working a day job, and so, you know, I could still manage to tour. But the needs, what a baby requires, is very different from what an 8-year-old requires. And so we had a deal that we came up with back then. That was, okay, you can do maximum 2 weeks on the road.
Yeah.
And then you have to do minimum 2 weeks home after that. And we really stuck to that for a while. You know, there were a good 3 or 4 years because, you know, we had the one kid, and then the second one was born. And so that seemed like a pretty good thing. And it's also the nice thing about not having that much success is you can kind of choose when you tour.
Right.
if nobody cares that you're coming to their town, then it doesn't matter whether you come in April or October.
Right.
And so that panned out for a while. But then as things started getting better for me and it was a little higher level of success, you know, there were situations where something would pop up, a tour where I was opening for somebody, and I would say, well, listen, honey, I've been offered a 3-week run, what do you think about that? And she would go, well, why don't you do it, and then we'll talk afterwards. And so
see, that's seemed really healthy.
Yeah, so I would do it, and we would talk afterwards, and she might go, you know, that was a little much. If you're going to do it, maybe do it once a year. And I go, okay. And then we get a couple more years down the road, and the kids are in school, and she's got more free time to do her stuff. And,
right.
And, I mean, last year I did 2 months solid, home for 4 days, and then I was gone for a month, and then home for 3 days and gone for another month. And that was intense. It was like basically 4 months. I think I was gone 4 months and 12 days home. But the last several years, we've been taking off the entire month of July. So like I'll work really intensely in the spring, take a whole month off with my family where I don't work at all.
And nobody, camping, and everyone just does, that's
just have fun.
Awesome.
And then I work like crazy until Christmas.
Right.
And financially, that was a way that we were able to make it work. After that 4 month span, you know, we checked in and it was like, that was a little much.
Yeah.
That was pushing the envelope.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, well, this year we'll dial that back a little
bit.
And so it's just this constant changing, growing.
Well, plus you put out a new album last year and, you know, takes a little bit more of, you know.
Yeah.
Well, that's amazing. That's great that you have that kind of understanding and I'm glad that it's called Checking In. I like that.
Well,
it's better than Facebook Checking In.
Yeah. I think it's the only way, maybe not the only way. To us, we've found it to be the most healthy way.
Because you're keeping open
the
line of communication.
Going.
Yeah.
Because I think if you're not communicating about that stuff, you're gonna build up
resentments.
Resentment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's like cancer. So let's go back to the night that you went to Saxon Pub and you came home. Sorry to rewind.
Oh, that's all right.
And digress, but go back to you came home and you told your wife, "Hey, I went to Saxon Pub and there's like a whole world of music going on here."
Well, yeah, and just that idea that people like yourself, people like Casey Crowley, people at the time, those were all the people that, you know, I'm seeing in the Chronicle playing all the time.
Yeah.
And had never known anybody because I didn't go to school here. I didn't grow up here.
Right.
I wasn't part of
a scene.
I missed the Chicago house.
Right.
I missed a lot of these things that other people I knew seemed to have. That was their entering, you know, spot. And I kind of missed out on that. And so, but I realized that just the act of going down and just hanging out. And you start talking to people and they go, "Oh yeah, I've seen your name in the paper, but I've never ever seen you out because, you know, so I've never come to see you." And it was kind of...
it's almost like staying fresh in people's minds.
Well, certainly from like a marketing branding standpoint.
Yeah.
But also, you know, what continues to be my favorite part about Austin, and that was like my baptism into what I love about Austin the most, is that music, business aside, gigs aside, the community here is what to me is so unique.
Yeah.
And it's not to say that there's not one, if not a thousand, music communities in New York or in L.A. or in Nashville or in Portland.
But you're here
and
you're in this one. And
this one, to me, seems, having lived in a couple of these other cities and having and travel there all the time and know people that live there, this one is special. I mean, maybe it's because there's not as much industry here.
Yeah.
Except for,
I think,
you know,
that's what a lot of it has to do with it, you know, that people can still reach the industry somehow, and then we've learned how to create our own industry.
Yeah.
You know, even like in the early 90s and stuff, you know, when all of us were out touring the same way that you guys were in the Northwest, it was the same kind of thing. We learned how to make a living doing it. I mean, someone like Bob is the most perfect example that guy, just his ability to be industrious has paid off in a career that's really nice, you know, very, very good career.
Yeah.
When did you met him around that time? Did you say it was around 2000?
It was around 2001 that I quit the job, and right around that time, a lot of kind of good stuff started happening, and I just in terms of, I met so many more people and realized that, like, hey, all these names in the paper, they're actually nice people.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I knock on wood, but in all the years here, I've never met anybody from any subgenre or different genre of music in this town that hasn't been a really nice person.
Yeah.
I mean, I know there's, you know, dicks everywhere, whatever, but I've met guys in metal bands. I've met, you know, people in, like, you know, the hip hop crowd. Everybody just seems welcoming and friendly, and there doesn't seem to be as much of that cutthroat competitive vibe for gigs.
Right.
You know, everybody wants to get gigs.
Yeah, but it's not like LA where like you getting a gig doesn't make someone else feel like you're taking something from them, which is some weird kind
exactly.
of like odd competitiveness or just fear, like this massive like ego of feeling left out. Like, oh, I must not be yeah. happening if Matt the Electrician is playing tonight.
Yeah, well, you know, exactly. Why would that? It's, yeah. I know that, you know, again, there's cliques. But
sure.
everybody just seems generally, genuinely friendly.
Yeah.
And so, you know, right around that same time, I guess it was after I quit, I met Bruce. My bass player at the time lived next door to him in this apartment complex, and Bruce had just bought this house. And so he, you know, Bruce said, hey, is this guy you play with, is he really an electrician? And he said, yeah. So he hired me to wire his house, and it took forever. It was an old, ancient house, just yeah. as you know. Yeah. Fallen apart in some ways, but so I got to know him while I was there, and I also thought it was really kind of apropos that you know, here I was hanging out with this guy that was in Poydog Pondering like every day,
yeah,
wiring his house. And at a certain point I asked him, I said, hey, would you ever be interested in producing a record for me? And he said, yeah, absolutely, you know, play me some songs. And so we did that, and he ended up producing the next two records,
which were Made for Working and Long Way Home.
Yeah, that was okay. In 2003, I think, the first one came out.
I think that's when I first saw you around yeah. that time, because I yeah. think I first saw you. That's when you started doing that, the Mondays with Bob. You still do that?
We actually just stopped like 4 or 5 months ago, but we had done it for about 9 or 10 years. It would be, you know, 9 years, I guess.
That must have helped immensely.
It was insane. Well, and that came about, you know, I'm sure it wasn't totally random, but... because I know that Bruce was playing in his band.
Right.
But it was one of those funny things, and you and I both know Bob, so we know how this can work. But I was opening a show for Bob back when it was a different band every Monday.
Right.
And I had gotten a booking agent at that point, and she booked us into two of those slots. They didn't pay. They were just tip shows.
Right, yeah.
But I was all excited to be there. And the second night, inexplicably, Bob showed up for the last three songs we did.
Right.
And I've toured a lot with that guy. He does not watch the opening band ever. Not even just because...
But just to keep himself fresh. If you sat out and watch a show every night right before you play a show, it would be hard.
It gets him thinking in a different way. You know, and you don't always want that.
His shows, they're long, and he gives a lot, you know.
Mm-hmm. Sort of,
yeah. He's got to keep his chi together.
Exactly. But so, randomly, seemingly, he showed up, watched two, maybe three songs, and by the time we were loading out, he was standing in front of the Saxon with David Cotton, and he just pointed at me. He said, I want that guy to open all the Mondays.
For just a decade.
From here on out. If he wants them, he can have them. And David was like, all right. And
yeah, because that was like, he's got the other prime spot.
It was a good place for him to put bands.
That is the best spot, because the other one is the prime slot that he tries to sell you on whenever you're there. Well, you know, we got this great slot after Bob.
Yeah.
Have you ever seen a place empty out right before you hit your first chord and play to no one when a place was literally sold out 26 minutes ago?
Yeah. No, and we did a couple of those before we did the openers.
That's a character building.
But it was hilarious because there's Bob. He's pointing at me. I don't know the guy. I've never met him. And he says, I want this guy to do them. And he walks over to me and goes, man, killer songs. I love what you're doing. I said, thanks. And Bruce walks up loading up his stuff. And he's just looking. He's got his hands out. And he's going, Bob, I've been telling you about this guy for like a year. And Bob's like, huh, I don't remember that.
Yeah.
So, you know, whether or not Bruce put the seed in his head,
right?
Whatever it was. Either way,
you ended up with a pretty cush gig, a good gig.
It's been fantastic. And over the years, I did some national touring with him. I did 3 or 4 national tours that were fantastic. And, you know, just really, it really
helped.
That's
another thing that I've always wanted to, I always try to tell people, because I did 1 or 2 with him as well. And he does well everywhere. People have this kind of like, oh, well, like he does well in Austin.
Yeah.
You know, like that's bad.
Right.
It's usually people that aren't even doing well in Austin that are saying that. But at the same time, I mean, here's this, you know, he does do well all over the country, and you play to a lot of people.
Yeah.
And a lot of times his crowd, him choosing you to do this tour gives you a little bit of almost him saying to the crowd, like, check this guy out.
Yeah.
And they do, because he's got a really intense following.
I remember years ago, probably in late 90s, reading an article with some band. I won't name them, but I also don't remember what they were called because they were there and then they disappeared.
Right.
But at, for a moment, you know, they had an article in the Chronicle, and Bob had recently had like the cover story.
Right.
And in the cover story, he had said, you know, my goal is I want every person in Austin to buy my record. You know, he just said that's one goal I have. And yeah. At the time, the guy had sold whatever 40,000-50,000 records just at Waterloo.
Yeah.
You know, he had outsold Willie Nelson,
the Beatles,
everybody.
Yeah.
And I remember reading that and thinking like, wow. And you know, and I knew him at the time. Or no, maybe I guess I didn't. That was late 90s. Anyway, but this guy in this other band the next week or 2 weeks later is in this article, and he, you know, maybe it was partly a put on or some kind of attitude. He was, you know, it was like kind of a rock band, and he said, you know, I read that article with, you know, Bob Schneider talking about everybody in Austin buying a record. Well, fuck Bob Schneider. And you know what? Fuck everybody in Austin. We're gonna be nationwide. We're gonna be international. You know, and it's like, that's great. You know, you're in a rock and roll band. Get that rock and roll attitude out there. But you know, I never heard about that band ever again.
No.
I mean, they were just gone. And I thought, you know,
I have a feeling I know exactly who you're talking about.
Oh yeah.
So I will also refrain from saying their name. But I remember this. I just remember that this was a kind of they came out with this attitude thinking that it would be really cool to be like Oasis.
Right. Yes.
And it was predetermined that he was going to go to this interview and do this attitude thing. Because
It seemed
this
like
band and I had the same lawyer at the time.
It seemed like it was partly a put on, like it was a chosen.
Yeah, but he just turned every. I mean, that was a big deal. I mean, for me to sit here and say that I remember 13 years ago, I know exactly what article you're talking about. I don't remember the Bob stuff, but I remember that attitude and fuck this Austin, I'm not going to do, you know. We're the great, and then
that's one thing to do an interview in the New York Times,
exactly.
And say,
but in your own hometown,
but to do it in the Chronicle, it's like this is a small town essentially, and everybody remembers that stuff.
Yeah.
And it's like, there are people who don't like Bob Schneider, are they going to really want to go out and see you with like if your whole attitude is that?
You better be good or light yourself on fire or be dating a supermodel or something amazing better be happening in your life that's going to justify, because when I go to this show, I'm there to see you fail.
Yeah.
So you did those records with Bruce, and you toured with Bob, and you toured on your own too. Did you tour a lot solo, or did you take your band out a lot?
I did a lot of solo touring, and then I did a little bit of duo touring with Sela, my backup singer.
Okay, yeah.
And then once a year we would do a West Coast thing with the band, because it was the only place where I had a kind of a solid foundation.
Right.
And we did that for a number of years, and then I kind of pulled back. I got to a point where I realized that as a father and a husband, I needed to be making more money.
Right.
And even though we were doing all right with those tours and making a little bit of money, I wasn't making enough money.
Right. To justify doing the whole thing.
Yeah.
Right.
And so I guess 4 or 5 years ago, I started doing primarily solo and duo touring, sometimes with Sela, sometimes with Scrappy. Mm-hmm. And that's been pretty much it the last 4 or 5 years. I do mostly that, and even now things are going great on the road, and I do a lot of solo touring because it's, you know,
right,
and the band, you know, they've all got, most of them have day gigs, and those who don't play in 7 other bands, and
right,
and so nobody's too upset that you know, we play when we're together in Austin, and that's fun.
That's another thing that happens in Austin, that people are kind of okay with that, like they won't resent you too much because they understand everyone's kind of working, and a lot of times people are in a couple of different bands, and you know, I'm sure that happens other places, but it seems to be very prominent here.
Well, there's a lot of singer-songwriters here, and,
right?
And I mean, there's a lot of bands too, but that's just a scene that I've never been as big a part of. Is that the band scene where you're
right.
a band,
yeah,
you all work together,
and, yeah,
you play one show every 2 months,
right?
You know, you do the posters together. You
yeah,
do all
yeah, yeah.
For me, it was always, I'm hiring these guys anyway, and
so
if I can't afford to hire them, I just shouldn't hire them.
Right.
You know?
That's the same kind of the attitude that I've had. I guess it's also easy when you can do your own solo stuff. But you do like house concerts and stuff like that as well?
I do lots of that, yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
How do you like that?
I love it.
Yeah?
I do. It's probably 50% of my road work these days.
Yeah? And it does end up being like a lot better financially than
They're usually
club
better
stuff.
Financially.
Yeah.
For me, stylistically, what I do, I... it works better for me too.
And you're not like at a bar that people aren't there to see. You're yeah. literally playing in an event that's centered around you.
Yeah.
Even if it is smaller, and yeah. it's people that are interested in listening to you, and they can't really go to someone's house and talk through your whole
right.
solo
well, and
acoustic
thing. Bottom line, I'm incredibly narcissistic, and so you know I don't want to go somewhere where it's not all about me anyway.
Right. Exactly. Who doesn't? Or who does? I certainly don't. So, yeah. So you've gone to Japan?
Yeah.
How's that?
It's wonderful. I've been touring there once a year for the last 5 years.
Wow.
And I'm going again this year in October.
So how do you get there? I always thought that I would be accepted there because I feel like I look like Speed Racer.
You do look a little bit like Speed Racer.
I know, so I thought like I'm like kind of what they want out of.
Well, I think if you call your next band Speed Racer, then
that's what I'll do.
Then you're totally.
Or at least in Japan, we'll be Speed Racer.
Yeah.
So how did that come about?
That was a South by Southwest meeting. That there were these two kind of smaller niche Japanese promoters that came over here every year for South by for a number of years. And they were initially, I think both of them really, initially were big fans of Troy's old band, the Loose Diamonds.
Right.
And so they already just, they had an affinity and a love for kind of the, you know, Americana, alt-country kind of stuff. And they loved Austin. And they both were, one lives in the west, the southwestern part of the country near Hiroshima, and the other lives near Tokyo in Kamakura. And so they were doing these kind of tag team tours where they'd bring people over and then they wouldn't have to travel as much, but they'd put people on a train and go to this other part of the country
right.
and play. And they're real small.
How many shows do you end up doing?
It's like 11 or 12 shows.
Oh,
you're there
good.
For about 2 weeks. And, you know, it's very small venues usually, like the smallest I've ever played. I think capacity was 15 people and it was sold out. But then I've played a...
You can come back and be like, sold out shows in Japan.
Well, that's the thing. Is across the board, the shows were really well attended or sold out everywhere you'd play. And they're just... The way the promoters would set it up is like, if you played a room that fit 30, there'd be 30 people there. If you played a room that fit 100, there'd be 100 people there. But they knew kind of what room to book in each place to make that... To make it just a full event wherever you went. And the money's great and the people are great, and it's you get to go to Japan.
Yeah, totally. Do you sell a lot of music there?
Yeah, totally.
Let me ask you this, because this is something that I've been kind of trying to figure out, even for myself, is like the physical product. Like, do you find that it's kind of like, do you still sell CDs? Like, I imagine when you go to Japan, people probably want a thing from you, right?
Yeah,
when you go somewhere far away, that they won't really be able to get it.
Well, there's Japanese iTunes. I mean, there's
right. But I mean, like it's, I don't know.
But it does seem the people that come to the shows will buy the CDs.
Right.
If you have vinyl, they'll buy the vinyl. I mean, I would say definitely I sell more physical product in Japan and in Europe than I do in the States.
Yeah.
And even in the States, because I'm playing so many house concerts and so many like folk
right,
type
things, sign a lot of stuff.
It's an older crowd, and they're not dialed.
Right.
You know, they might download some things now and again, but they're not dialed into that yet. That whole situation, the digital format versus
it's pretty intense to what we do. I mean, it's very
it's something we have to all figure out.
Yeah.
But I'm finding that there's a lot of these kind of forums, and you know, whether it's at a place like South by Southwest or Folk Alliance Conference or
right.
something like that, where a bunch of people get in a room and they talk about like, what are we going to do?
Right.
To me, it's felt like a case by case. You have to decide, you have to look at your own numbers and go, what am I selling on the road physical and what am I doing in digital? And you know, if you're doing 80% digital and 20% physical, then yeah, maybe your crowd, your fan base, your demographic requires or at least doesn't require
a physical
right, product. Right. So just stop doing it.
Yeah.
Or if you're going to do it, do really short runs so you're not blowing money on 5,000
CDs.
And
then you've got a closet filled with fucking...
Right. But for me, personally, I've found that that I still sell CDs. So I remember somebody asking in 2008 or 2009, you know, the recession was hitting hard, and they said, man, how's it for musicians? How's it for you guys? And I said, well, we're musicians. We're always in a recession.
We're always poor.
Like, you know, I didn't see my numbers change that much because I'm not looking at millions. I'm not looking at hundreds of thousands. I'm looking at, you know, several thousand anyway.
Yeah.
So give or take 20 or 30, I'm not really even going to notice that.
Right.
So it didn't, I didn't notice a big downturn for what I was doing at that point.
Right.
And it could have just had to do with, at that moment in time, things were going a little better for me than they had before. So for me, it was all looking good.
Right, anyhow. Right.
I was like, well, you know, I'm getting more radio play now, so I'm selling more product than I would have sold last year.
Right. And yeah. how's that working? Are you still getting radio play? Did you get some, mm-hmm. is it more regional? Do you tour regionally? Do you play like in Dallas and Houston a lot?
I do. Houston has been doing really well for me over the years, and Dallas not so much, but I keep going back and trying. Right. San Antonio's been probably the most difficult of the
Texas
cities.
That really is
cities.
A difficult town.
It is. There's,
what we do.
There's not, I mean, for songwriters, there's not, there used to be a room down there and it disappeared.
Oh, yeah, the French lady.
Yeah, the Red Room.
The Red Room. Yeah, I played there.
And that was a cool place, but, it, you know, you never made a ton of money or anything, but it was, at least it was people that wanted to see you play.
No.
But now it's just a lot of bars and...
There's a Havana Hotel there now.
Yeah. We were talking about that the other day, that Liz Lambert owns, I think.
Yeah. So what do you have going on? What do you have coming up? What do you have going on this year? Like, do you have anything going on next week for South by Southwest?
Yeah, I'm doing a whole bunch next week. We made a decision this year. Usually I try to play as much as humanly possible.
Yeah.
And year by year, I've been toning that down a little bit. I stopped applying to the conference maybe 6 or 7 years ago for any kind of official stuff. I know that there's...
If someone's in town, you can get them to come see you whether or not you're in the conference.
Well, and I know that there's wildly divergent opinions about South by Southwest. And over the years, I've tried to tone down even my own rhetoric about what South by is or is supposed to be or what have you. And
who even knows what it's supposed to be? Well, it's a music conference.
That's the thing, is I know so many, I know a lot of people that are real bitter about it. And I used to be real bitter about it. And I started to realize through the help of my wife... that just in general, that kind of bitterness is never going to really get you anywhere anyway, and it doesn't really serve to help you.
It's a good wife. I have a girlfriend that tells me every once in a while, like, I know you think you're being funny, but complaining about everything all the time really isn't that funny.
Well, and that's what she would say a lot. And at some point, it finally hit home, and I understood what she was saying, and I realized, you know, South by Southwest... in and of itself, as a music conference, as something to apply to and push yourself to, it turns out, is not my bag. It doesn't seem to work for me. It doesn't seem to do a lot. But if there was no South by Southwest, there's a lot of things that wouldn't have happened for me over the years through other channels. So in that way, I embrace...
Like the Japanese guys.
The Japanese guys. There's Europe stuff that's happened out of that. Most every year, including this year, I have a lot of friends that come to town to play shows that I don't get to see, but once a year.
Yeah.
And my favorite thing at South by the last 3 years has been some friends that have like a house party, one of the nights where it's just a Kerrville style guitar swap.
Oh, that's cool.
And it's like we're completely avoiding downtown. We're avoiding South by altogether.
Right.
And yet, without South by, That party doesn't really happen,
right? Yeah.
And so in that way, I've come to terms with like embracing it for what it is. It's this thing that draws a lot of people here, and that's fantastic.
Yeah.
Do I have to go downtown and hand out postcards?
No.
I don't, and that's okay.
Yeah.
Like I don't have any, and part of that hurdle for me was I had to stop applying because what would happen is every year I would apply,
and then if they don't get in,
and if I didn't get in,
you feel like they didn't everyone's cool except for Matt,
right? I didn't. Why am I not in that club?
Yeah.
You know, and I would have great things going on, records selling great, KUT playing the shit out of the record, and I would come home and cry to my wife like, why does everybody hate me? And she's like, you're an idiot.
Yeah.
Stop.
Yeah.
This festival's gigantic.
Yeah.
They don't care about anybody. I mean, you know, as an entity,
right,
they don't.
Yeah.
It's just
what they care about is if Springsteen's going to do it his thing, you know, and whatever new band is like, you know, being hyped and stuff like that.
And if you let that stuff become a part of your inner dialogue about how you rank in that, it's a no-win situation.
Yeah.
But if you accept it as like, well, that's what this festival is.
Yeah.
Okay. Cool.
Yeah.
Let it be that, and my buddy John from LA is going to come out here because it's happening, and I get to hang out with him and write songs.
There you go.
So, hey, I win, you know.
Yeah, and I think even South by Southwest is starting to look at it, like even like all the other festivals that I'm sure must just be kind of a pain in the ass when you are bringing, you're responsible for bringing everyone here, and then like Steve's got like, hey, you know, South by, you know, 12th Street. Yeah. You know, they always use the South by intro to it. South by, you know.
Yeah. No, they're just trying to run a business, and you know.
And it still works out because they still have more and more people coming every year, South by Southwest, and signing up. Yeah. And
well, and the only times even after I turned over a leaf about my attitude towards it, the only thing that would continue to kind of bother me about it had nothing to do with me. It was, I would feel bad sometimes for international bands that were younger.
Oh my God.
And didn't know what it really is, and they spend all this money on tickets, they spend all this money on all this stuff, and then they get here and they realize
they think Clive Davis and David Geffen are going to be sitting in the front.
Nobody's going to come.
Yeah.
And so the only thing I ever hoped that maybe South by would do on some level is to like kind of be somewhat responsible for the rebranding of what it is they do. Because in the letters to the editor 2 weeks in the Chronicle after South by, you know, those guys are perfectly happy to have a debate with somebody who writes in and says, South by is supposed to be about discovering new talent. And they write back and go, well, no, it's not. We never said that.
No, it's a music conference.
But the reputation of that. And if you don't tell a guy in Japan or you don't tell the guy in Sweden that, hey, man, this isn't necessarily about discovering new talent.
Right.
It's just a clusterfuck of a party.
Yeah.
If they know that going in and go, oh, okay, I want to go to a clusterfuck of a party, so I'm gonna buy a $1,300 ticket for me and five of my friends, and we're gonna rent drums and we're gonna rent a truck that we can't drive anywhere because the traffic's too insane.
Right.
If they know all that going in, great, more power to them. But I feel so bad for the people that spend tens of thousands of dollars to get here only to find out that they're playing at 7 p.m. on Tuesday and nobody's going to be at their show.
Yeah, a couple years ago I did a show and I was in the South by Southwest thing and I was the second band on the bill the first night, I think. And it was the second bill on like... the first night of the second person on the bill. And so some girl that had a big record deal had the PA the whole time all day doing the sound check thing, and it was completely different setup than my band. It took our sound guy about 20 minutes to do it, and then we played literally 15 minutes with the worst sound you can imagine. And just like all I could think was like, God, thank God I fucking live here.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? Thank God I didn't come from even Dallas.
I can just go home and go to bed.
This sucked. I'm leaving.
No, you know, and there were some interim years where I decided, okay, I'm not going to do the festival, but I am going to play 22 shows between Monday and Monday.
That's tough.
And it was, you know, it was insane. And by the end of it, you're a mess and you're sick.
And usually about
else.
15 of those shows are not great.
Yeah, just worthless.
Like you're not at your best.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I think this might be the first or second year that I've really decided. I mean, I think I'm playing 4 or 5 shows. Oh, and what we decided to do this year is this coming Friday during film, before music's even started, we're doing a show at Threadgills.
Oh, great.
Which, you know, completely on the heels of doing a really good show at Threadgills last summer, they said, look, we want to have you at this prime spot. And I said, man, that's great.
That is great.
And it gets to be like, you know, what Bob does every year, which is just play a bunch of shows where you actually have a ticket cover and you might make some money.
Yeah, you make a little money. Imagine that. Yeah.
And so, you know, that's the goal this year is I'm barely playing during South by at all. And the weekend before, I'm playing one hopefully big show that if it doesn't get rained out and if my fans decide to come out, I'll have just a nice show. And then during South by, I can just visit my friends and...
Right.
You know.
So that's this Friday, that's the 9th, right?
Yeah.
March 9th. Great. Excellent, man. So everyone that's listening to this, come out Friday, March 9th to Threadgills. You have is someone opening? Who's opening?
Yes, Dana Falconberry is opening.
Oh, awesome.
Who I love. Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's awesome. And people can find your music on your website, mattheelectrician.com.
Yeah, there's all sorts of links to videos and music and stuff.
Yeah. And you have any tours planned at all coming up or anything?
Yeah, I'm going back to Europe in mid-April. I'll be in the Netherlands and Denmark. And I have some festival stuff in the Midwest in July.
Fantastic.
I'm going to Japan in October.
Well, great. Are you planning a new record or still working this one?
I've been writing a lot.
Okay.
And so I don't know when I don't know when that's all going to start. I know it's been almost a year since my last record came out, but I still feel like right. it's fresh. It's
still
in my,
fresh, yeah.
Still fresh in my brain.
Yeah, it's, so. Everyone check it out. Accidental Thief. It's produced by you and Mark Addison.
That's right.
And so, how many albums do you have out? 8.
I think with the live record, it's 9.
9. Yeah. 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 Check out Matt the Electrician. And do we leave anything out? Do you need to say hi to anyone? I think your wife is cool, and I don't even know her, but she's very cool.
I think she's very cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, congratulations on being Matt Sever.
Thanks, John.
The Electrician.
I appreciate it.
Thank you, man.
But I need to talk about it, and I can't do it alone.
All right, man. That was my guest, Matt the Electrician. I really enjoyed our conversation. We had it outside at my ex-girlfriend's house, so dogs were lively, and the birds were chirping. Thank you so much for listening. I guess I will talk to you soon. Here's a little bit more Matt the Electrician. Bye. Thank you.